Welcome to the Legal Eagles radio show, where we explore the legal issues of the day, especially in Connecticut, where we originate. We look at the civil and criminal justice system, both at the state and federal levels. We talk to lawyers and judges and folks connected to the law in various ways. And we look at our legislature and what direction they happen to be going in any one day. And actually, going is very appropriate for the topic of the day. Today, we welcome Adam Blank. And Adam's going to tell us where he works.
Yeah, this is Adam Blank, and I work at Wofsy, Rosen, Kreskin & Kuryansky, a law firm down in Stamford.
Well, that's great, and we're so happy that you could join us today. Adam was recently appointed to a state task force to study the feasibility of fully autonomous cars. That means driverless cars in Connecticut. Folks, can you picture that? Adam, tell us about that.
So there's a task force been created by the legislature to look into driverless cars in Connecticut and to make some recommendations about getting up to about four cities in Connecticut running some pilot testing and programming for driverless cars. And the task force will also, it's expected the task force will also make some recommendations about what the law should be in Connecticut concerning driverless cars or robot cars, as they're sometimes called.
And what was the reason for this task force? What generated the statute or the legislature to do this?
I think there are a number of reasons, I think, caused it. I know that there was a desire, at least down in Stamford, mm-hmm. To start testing out driverless cars, or at least to promote themselves as being open to bringing in some new companies to the state and to Stamford to test software and hardware. And it was not clear that that would be legal. So they put a push on for this. And there's also a push by the industry to make sure that it's allowed. And there was a push by trial lawyers and others to make sure that it was regulated in a way that people aren't going to be getting hurt and killed as a result of driverless cars.
Right. Now, you said four cities were interested in these. Which cities?
Well, the state has said that they will allow
up to four cities to
become test cities. Mm-hmm. And I know Stamford's expressed interest. I believe that New Haven and Hartford may also be on the list, and maybe Waterbury. Mm-hmm. But I think Stamford's the only one that's formally said, you know, sort of, we're in if you'll take us.
Okay, so now this task force, I would imagine, is connected to the State Department of Transportation?
Yeah, the task force is actually comprised of, there's 11 appointed members that are appointed. The state statute sets out how they're appointed, but basically they're appointed by politicians at the state level. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to those sort of 11 regular folks, and I'm one of those regular folks, there's commissioner of the DMV, the secretary of Office of Policy Management, the commissioner of transportation, and the EMS commissioner. Those are the agencies that are involved with the task force.
EMS stands for Emergency Service.
Yeah, the Emergency Medical Services.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But the DOT, the Department of Transportation, is at least currently assigned to staff the task force and to help get us going and keep us moving forward.
Okay, so now it hasn't met yet?
Or? It hasn't met yet. Mm-hmm. There were some delays because of the budget impasse in the fall, and I've been told that it will be meeting quite shortly, mm-hmm. but I don't have a firm start date on that.
Okay. So what got you interested in this area as a lawyer?
So two different things got me interested in it as a lawyer. Number one is my practice is in large part personal injury, so uh-huh. car accidents.
Right.
And I was very interested mm-hmm. in driverless cars, both as to how they can potentially prevent some car accidents, mm-hmm. And also what happens when one of those is involved in a car accident. Mm-hmm. How does our legal system work to make sure that there's a fair and efficient process for resolving those types of accidents?
I mean, typically, and you know this obviously, I mean, one gets involved in these things because there are people in a car. So if somebody does something wrong and hits somebody else, that person might get sued. Now, absent a person, what happens?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, and that's not really fair to say that nobody knows. But the states have just started to tackle this issue. They've mm-hmm. not done it uniformly, and there's not, because these cars aren't really out there on the roads yet, with some limited exceptions, there's not a lot of cases. There aren't cases.
So there are no cases that we know of yet.
No, I assume I assume that there probably will be one with this Arizona crash, but I don't, you know,
okay,
we
so
don't know
tell
much
us
about
this,
that.
Tell us, actually, I was just parking my vehicle, the man just told me all about a case involving an Uber. Was this yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday there was the first that we know of crash involved a fatality with a driverless car crashing into a pedestrian that was walking with a bicycle.
Oh.
And I think if I can move back for a second, and
sure.
then we can maybe talk a little bit more about that.
Yes.
But just so I don't know, familiar your audience is about. Mm. So when you hear driverless cars or mm-hmm. automated vehicles, robot cars, any of those terms, they don't always mean the same thing.
Oh,
and
okay.
So there are what's starting to be adopted as a sort of a system of four different levels of autonomy, four different levels of car being driverless.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're level zero. Well, I guess it's five, level zero to four.
Okay.
So that's five. So at level zero, there's nothing sort of automated about your driving experience. It's all the driver.
Mm-hmm.
And then levels one and two, there are certain features that are automated. So you can have a adaptive cruise control, the braking, the automatic braking assist mm-hmm. when something comes out in front of you, or mm-hmm. the blind spot warning and the lane departure warning and all of these sort of systems where there's still a human at the wheel who's primarily responsible for the driving.
Right.
But if you mess up, there's a computer system there to quickly try to take over and minimize the chance of you being in a crash.
Stay in the right lane.
so that's the more basic automated levels. And then you can get to a level where the car, for the most part, drives itself under most or some circumstances,
mm-hmm.
but wouldn't drive itself under others. So maybe it only drives itself on highways. Maybe it only drives itself during daytime, or only drives itself on clear days, but not in inclement weather.
Who decides that?
Well, the car companies and the manufacturers of the software would decide what the limitations are of the equipment.
I see.
And then at the furthest end, a truly 100% fully autonomous self-driving car doesn't need a steering wheel, doesn't need a brake pedal. Under all conditions, at all times, the car will drive itself. So there's a pretty broad spectrum of sort of how animated a car might be. And right now there's a lot of the stuff on the lower levels that are already out there, right? You know, you've got your Teslas and a lot of the cars now has options have some automation that you can purchase in your car.
Is this aimed at any particular age group? Because I could think of certain age groups that might really love it.
Well, I would assume that it's going to be that a younger demographic,
uh-huh.
but what it's I think what one of the larger drivers of it now is not at an age group that might be interested in being in one of these vehicles, but it's the trucking industry.
Oh, tell us about that.
And so truck drivers are expensive. You can eliminate 3 or 4 million truck drivers with driverless trucks.
Driverless trucks.
And that's the truck industry is very excited about this because you can take a driverless truck, you can line 5, 10, 100 of these trucks up together, and you can run them at a high speed in very close proximity to each other, like a train. And so they would run them like a train so they can draft off of each other, and they save a lot on their, like 10% or so on fuel economy. And they're not paying for a driver to operate the vehicle, and it can operate 24 hours a day because you don't need to rest. So they can ship goods much quicker and much cheaper. And so that industry is very excited about the prospect of driverless cars.
Do we have a driverless truck yet?
There are driverless trucks that are being tested. There's certainly not. I don't think
they're
there's
not,
any that, that are
no one's
none
out
that,
there yet
that are really running.
Well, that would obviously transform that industry.
Yeah, and so this there are some positives and some negatives about that, right? So you know, you're talking about there are millions of truck drivers. Those folks don't have a job.
And aren't many of them unionized?
They are, but many of them aren't. And that's including the local delivery guys. It's not all 18-wheel big trucks, but they're smaller trucks, and maybe now you don't need a licensed driver. You just need somebody sitting in the truck with your UPS packages who the truck, stops door to door and he runs out and brings the package in.
Yeah, I know. In Connecticut, we've had such trouble with our transportation situation and with our local places where you have to renew your driver's license. I know many people would be very happy not to renew their driver's license because they wouldn't need one, right? I mean, that's the end of driver's licenses. No? Conceivably. I mean, not the end, but it raises an issue.
Yes, and maybe there's a different license that's required to essentially operate or own a driverless vehicle that has a different criteria for what makes you eligible, or that's simply a way for the state to charge a fee because they make money on driver's licenses.
So if we no longer have a person and our hands are free from the wheel and so forth, and free from watching the road, what does that mean for liability? As a liability lawyer, I would imagine this could be a transformative moment.
Yeah, it is. I think it's an important one, and not just for lawyers. I think for the industry and for the public, the promise of these vehicles are that they are going to very, very substantially reduce motor vehicle crashes and fatalities, right? So they're going to, and they say that if, let's give you a few statistics, about one-third of all car deaths or motor vehicle-related fatalities are alcohol-related.
Correct, yes.
So, alcohol, your robot car is not going to be drinking, right? So
it's not going to have one for the road, right?
No, you've got motor vehicle accidents are the leading cause of death among 15 to 29-year-olds. And
the leading cause.
The leading cause for 15 to 29-year-olds.
Wow.
And if you didn't even get to this fully autonomous vehicles, if you just put lane departure warning systems, side view, blind spot assist, adaptive headlights, the technology that's already out there and non-controversial, if you put that on all of the cars, they estimate that you'd eliminate a third of all car crashes. So if the industry says, hey, we're going to do these wonderful things to eliminate car crashes, and they've pushed for laws that make them either immune from being sued in a crash, even if it's their fault, or to make it very, very difficult to bring a claim against a manufacturer, either because it's very expensive or it's hard to get the data that you would need. So, for instance, if one of these vehicles crashes, just like in cars now, but in airplanes, you hear it more commonly, a black box.
Yes.
Right? So when these cars get rolled out, we'd hope that the federal government, and this part will probably come from the federal government, not from the states, that they'll require certain information to be maintained by the manufacturer of the driverless car in the event of a crash, and that information will then be made readily available to anyone injured in the crash as well as to the police, so that they can help figure out what caused this crash, why did this crash happen, what were the circumstances surrounding it. The manufacturers would rather not share that information.
Why am I not surprised? But let's just hypothetically take this case that occurred yesterday in Arizona. So you have a deceased pedestrian, and the driverless car is an Uber. So that's a company. So the family of the deceased would do what legally?
Well, so we
theoretically,
right? So we don't even know. Let's assume we have to start with the assumption, which is a big one, that the Uber was at fault somehow, or that right. the Uber didn't follow the rules of the road.
Right, and that may not be case.
It may not be the case. We don't know that. So one of the possibilities, and there are a number of possibilities about what legally will happen in Arizona. I couldn't tell you what Arizona has done mm-hmm. on this, if they've passed any laws about liability.
But
right. one of the things that I think is a potentially workable solution for this would be that the owner of the vehicle, whether that's Uber the company or whether that's some individual, but the owner of the vehicle is always responsible for the vehicle's actions. So if you can establish that the vehicle violated some rule of the road, it didn't act like if it was a person, like a person would do. The person in Arizona is crossing the street, maybe crossing the street.
Right.
Now,
could have been illegal. Right, illegal.
And the news has said that they weren't in a crosswalk, which may or may not mean it was illegal. But even if a person's crossing outside of a crosswalk, if you're driving down a main street that's straight and a person has crossed through one or two or three lanes of traffic, a reasonable driver, whether the person's in a crosswalk, the pedestrian's in a crosswalk or not, would be expected to see the pedestrian. They've already crossed a few lanes. You're looking in front of you and break their car. I think the Uber, they've said, was going 40 in a 35, which seems odd to me that it was speeding.
Mm-hmm. But not by much.
Well, but it's a driverless car, so it had to have been programmed to speed.
Oh, I see.
Right?
I got you. I'm not thinking driverless.
Yeah. So and that it didn't appear to have any kind of heavy braking prior to the impact, which makes you wonder why the sensors didn't see this person, and maybe it wouldn't have been able to avoid the crash. And again, we're sort of speculating because
this is total speculation. We have no facts.
So in a crash situation where the Uber would be at fault, what I've liked from what I've heard thus far about liability would be that the owner of the vehicle is always liable and responsible, but only if the vehicle does something that violates a rule of the road, a traffic safety law.
Right.
And however, the manufacturer of the vehicle would provide insurance at a fairly high amount that would cover the vehicle and the owner. Mm-hmm. So your claims against the owner of the car, and maybe that's somebody that lives in Connecticut, and we're talking years out now, but where it's a regular individual lives in Connecticut, owns one of these driverless vehicles, they would be the one that a claim would be made against, but they wouldn't have their own personal auto policy. Their auto insurance would come from the manufacturer.
Right. And then the analysis, the autopsy, so to speak, would be of the car as well as for the actions of the person in the street.
Yeah. Well, and under what I've sort of laid out, what a nice feature of that is, and which the industry I expect will be opposed to, is that the industry would much prefer that if someone's hit by a car, that you have to determine whether there's been a software defect or a hardware defect,
right.
whether that existed at the time of manufacture or happened later on. And those are called product defect claims. Those types of claims, they might require $100,000 or so of out-of-pocket costs of investigation and experts, and plus a whole lot of attorney time, but not the attorney's cost, just the experts to study and investigate would cost $100,000. On the other hand, if a car hits a pedestrian in the sidewalk, under what I've said, where all you have to establish is that the vehicle violated a rule of the road, you don't need any of those experts. You lose all of those costs of those claims because when you make the cost of investigating a claim so high,
right.
you eliminate the ability of the vast majority of people that would get injured to actually recover because no one's going to bring their claims. It's too expensive.
Right. Yeah, it's complicated. So, and it's also a new way of thinking. How do you get people to sort of think about driverless cars? And we're talking the legal end of it now, but just sort of adapting.
Do you mean drivers, or
drivers? The idea of looking to your right or left and there's no human being in the car.
I think that's going to be a challenge, and I think a lot of people aren't going to want to get into a vehicle that doesn't have a driver. But I think probably the way that it rolls out is that, you know, 10 years from now, most cars have lots of this sort of low level automation that we've talked about, and they're used to, you know, being on the highway and the car staying in the lane on its own and speeding up and slowing down based on traffic conditions on its own. And then you get the people at the forefront who are willing to be occupants in these driverless cars, and then over a period of time it becomes just established.
Right. For our audience, we are talking with Adam Blank, an attorney, and he's a member of the task force, which is studying driverless cars in Connecticut, when and if they ever get here, but this is fascinating. So you were talking about the younger generation. What about the older generation? If you think about your grandmother or whatever, or your parents, and they're reaching an age where they say, you know, give me the keys, you can't drive anymore, wouldn't this kind of car be perfect for them? In a way, because they just get in, and they don't need anything.
Yeah, and that's one of the the things that's touted about these vehicles is both for the very old, the very young, and the infirm, that this is going to provide mobility to a lot of folks that might not otherwise have it. your son or daughter, you can have the vehicle pick up from school and bring to the to tennis practice, and you don't have to be there for any of that,
right?
Which creates a lot of options, and same with for the elderly, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So there are some.
Maybe we could have driverless buses, like school buses. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
I mean, the school bus is a whole other art form. I understand, but it drives me nuts.
Well, and that, you know, so. Go back to that Arizona crash. When I said that there's different levels of driverless vehicles, one of the concerns that both the manufacturers as well as the public and those that are looking at regulating the industry have are that right now, if you're actively driving your car and you've got your hands on the wheel, you're sort of doing 99% of the actions that your car does is controlled by you, you're paying pretty good attention to what you're doing. If the car's completely self-driving, you don't have to pay attention at all, and that's great. But when it's somewhere in between, so the vehicle mostly drives its own, except for emergency situations when it can't or it doesn't, it's very hard to re-engage the driver. Because even if you're told, well, you're supposed to have your hands on the wheel and your feet on the gas or on the brake and be ready to go at a second's notice, when you take the same drive day after day and you don't have to do anything, you're going to be inclined to text. You're going to be inclined to turn to your left or your right and talk to somebody else in the car.
Right.
And then when that snap judgment call has to be made, you're not ready to make it. And so in the Arizona crash, it was in an autonomous mode. It was self-driving.
Right.
But there was an actual engineer who's a licensed driver and engineer who, with a wheel and a brake, to be able to take over in the event of an emergency. And at this point, it doesn't look like he did that. And we don't know why, but what we do know is that it's pretty hard to take over in an emergency.
Where is this engineer? The engineer is in the car.
In the car, where the normal driver would be.
Would be, right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So that's an issue with the technology. I do think when you talked about driverless school buses.
I'm just joking. I'm not. There's no kid that's going to get on a driverless. That was just a joke.
All right. But actually, what I do think you're going to see is that the way these vehicles tend to work is that they and each company is developing their own way of having the cars be able to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
But they use some form of GPS.
Mm-hmm.
They use some form of laser, radar, they call it LIDAR, they have Wi-Fi on them, they have lots of different infrared and regular cameras to perceive the world around them without having eyes. And And that can...
This is amazing.
It's pretty amazing, but it's also very complicated.
Uh-huh.
And so what they worry, one of the concerns is that you might not catch a pedestrian or a bicyclist. It might be easy to spot a truck with reflectors on the back, but maybe not a person.
I would think, particularly in a city like New Haven, the bicycle population would be a real issue.
Yeah, and so...
No?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the hard part is, you know, the vehicles work best when you've got nice, good daylight, when you've got perfectly striped roadways, when you don't have pedestrians, and really when you're going
and
at
cyclists.
Lower speeds. And cyclists, right.
Because New Haven wants cyclists.
Yeah, when most of the cities now are encouraging them.
Encouraging them.
Yeah.
Would that run contrary to the driverless car, or what? Well, is that an extra element?
Well, I think it makes it more complicated at the start, and that's why I do think you will actually see. I think you're going to see more driverless buses than cars at the beginning, because a lot of those buses can operate on a fixed route, particularly at universities and larger office campuses, and they know what the roadway's like. They know what the road conditions are. They can have plugged into them through their GPS exactly, and the mapping exactly what their route will look like, and it's not going to change. And
but that's within a certain
a confined campus
and speed.
And at a lower speed.
I see.
So
it doesn't get it into the city, per se.
But now, let's fast forward like 70 years from now. So now I think... The bicyclists get a nice benefit from this in cities like New Haven that are already fairly well developed, and you've got roadways where you don't really have enough room for the pedestrians and the cyclists, and you kind of try to jam them all in,
and it's nip and tuck,
yeah, right. and you need parking spots and all of this. So with driverless vehicles, a few changes I think happen. And this another reason that I got involved in this is I spent about 10 years. On the zoning commission in Norwalk, and when you start talking about urban planning, this will have a real impact on how cities operate. So number one, most people expect that driverless cars will result in a lower individual car ownership. An Uber or Lyft type of a system with a driverless vehicle is likely to be much more common.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to be able, the car's going to come and get them wherever they are, whenever they want, whether it's through a big company like Uber or Lyft, or whether you and three other people have agreed to share ownership of a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to own your own car because it can go, my wife works in Greenwich, I work in Stanford, she leaves before me. If we had one car, it could drop her off, come back and pick me up and bring her home and then come back and bring me home. And we wouldn't need a second car, you'd share. So when you start doing that, cars don't need parking spaces on the street here. You don't need parking spaces. You certainly don't need parking spaces in the garages and the lots.
Mm.
Now, that one hurts both the parking authority, the city, and the private owners who are making money off of those parking or have actually already paid to build expensive structured parking that's no longer so useful.
And parking meters, I might add.
And parking meters, you lose that revenue. But what you gain from some of that is now maybe you can get rid of a lot of the on-street parking, and that frees up some space.
Mm.
Now, let's assume that we're talking far out.
Mm-hmm.
Every car's driverless. Like railroad trains, when they pass each other, they miss by about 6 inches, not by 4 or 5 feet, right? So maybe you're...
It's horrifying.
It's scary, but maybe your car lanes no longer need to be the same width.
Right.
They can be smaller. Now, there's issues with emergency medical services. You got the fire trucks and how they're going to be designed so that they can emergency vehicles can get through. But if you can likely narrow your roads and eliminate some of your on-street parking, which allows you to have much safer pedestrian and bicycle-friendly streets in the long term.
In the long term. But meanwhile, you'd still have to have... What happens right now with a traffic light? I'm just curious. I just wanted to add that because I was thinking of a street right outside the studio. And,
and
the traffic light came to mind.
So there are a whole other realm of driverless vehicles is the driverless vehicles. And right now, most of the developers are focusing on a self-driving car that's basically a sort of autonomous vehicle. It's going to get information and software. It's going to get stuff uploaded to it through the internet or satellite, but it's going to operate on its own. It doesn't need any other technology out there. It's going to be a self-contained kind of a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also vehicle-to-vehicle technology, and that when I talked about earlier about trucks platooning or being a train,
right.
The trucks are going to would communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. That technology is vehicle-to-vehicle, where the vehicles can communicate. There's also something called vehicle-to-infrastructure.
Oh.
So the roadways could both have sensors on them so that the cars know whether they're in the roadway or not, whether there's snow on the ground or fog, but also they can communicate with the traffic light and know in advance, is it going to be red or green, or can it be changed to green because there's nobody else coming, so they can adjust their speed accordingly.
Amazing.
If you hit this all perfectly and every car is driverless, they're all communicating with each other and with the infrastructure, you no longer need traffic lights. And they estimate that on our current streets, including, you know, the highways, everything, you could accommodate 500 times more traffic than you can currently accommodate based on them being fully autonomous and communicating with each other.
Wow.
But it has to work perfectly.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, that's a big if.
Yeah, and yeah. So, and I think one of the things that sort of some of the other concerns that people have now are these vehicles. Number one, are they going to? What's going to happen with the data that they collect? So when you're in your vehicle on a driverless car, you should assume that it's going to now be. You can have it set up more like an office if you want to do work, or like your living room.
And, or if you were driving on a train, sitting on a train.
Yeah, but there is going to be a much higher focus on comfort and infotainment kind of stuff. So they're going to be selling you, you know, Netflix and whatever you can dream of to work in your vehicle. What happens with the data that they compile about both where you're going, when you're going there, what you're viewing, what you're doing, which is very valuable to the companies, and they do intend to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be made anonymous? Are people going to be able to pay to know what's Marcia done? For, you know, where has she gone over the last year?
Yeah, I would think when? This would be most fascinating in other aspects of lawsuits, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, they can track you. Is what
they can track you, but and can they hack you, too?
Oh yeah, I think they could.
And
right?
so you've eliminated a lot of little rear end accidents as a result of this technology. But do we wake up one morning when every GM car has been hacked and they all are hacked so that they crash at 90 miles an hour and you have a huge catastrophe? You know, I mean, you know,
as you describe it, that's
yeah. Can they hack in and kidnap you? You know, your car drives you off somewhere remote that you didn't want it to take you. Because somebody's taking control of it. I mean, there's some real privacy and safety concerns that are interesting.
They're fascinating, actually. Are there any other states that you know of in the country that have sort of moved along at a quicker pace than we have in Connecticut?
Or
have you looked at them or studied them?
Yeah, and I've looked at them. I don't have off the top of my head. I have it in my office, but some of the specific data. But Michigan is certainly ahead of us. Arizona's ahead of us. I think Pittsburgh, New York has started,
really?
and California. I mean, a lot of the states are starting to come around. But
to think about it.
To think about it, and for the most part, they've said, you know, come. Test your cars here, or we'll allow your driverless vehicles here, and we'll sort of worry about the details later.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not aware of a really good, comprehensive regulatory system that's in place in any of those states for how to deal with these vehicles in the long term.
So, have you driven a driverless car?
I have not. I have been told that the task force will sometime in the near future, or not driven, I guess, because it's driverless.
But you're driverless, but you know, have you been a passenger? Yes.
Yes. If I survive, I'll come back.
I'm still driving. That's the thing. I mean, yeah, but I would think that the task force would have to do that.
Yeah, or at least see it in action.
Yeah, yeah, that would be fun.
Yeah.
So what intrigues you the most about this challenge?
I don't know what intrigues me most, because I really do, I care sort of deeply about making sure that they're safe, mm-hmm. that when things go wrong, that there's a fair system in place. Mm-hmm. And I also love the sort of the futuristic promise of...
Yeah, that's exciting.
Of what some of the benefits that we might see out of these vehicles. Right. But remember, if they work and they work properly and they don't speed, and again, I think the one in Arizona that went in the crash... they said it was going 40 and a 35. I'm not sure how that happens, but I would think that they would be required to be programmed not to speed. And if that was the case and they work as well as the manufacturers say, they estimate that traffic tickets generate $3 to $7 billion a year of revenue for governments. Mm-hmm. That money would disappear.
Absolutely.
Because you're no longer going to have traffic tickets. You're no longer going to have taxi drivers.
Or
no
traffic court. I'm
traffic
like
court. You, and you're no longer going to have body shops, you know, by and large. And I expect that independent mechanics will go away too, because these cars will be required to be repaired through the manufacturer or something similar to that. So I think government, and I'm not even talking about regulating, but government needs to be thinking about what impact this will have in the short term and the long term on the state and on the country, and be planning accordingly.
Right, and on revenues and on many different aspects.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about everything, and also you just mentioned, you know, crashes. Like, what if two driverless cars crash?
What happens if they crash in the woods?
Right. What happens if you crash in the woods? That's an old law case, right? If you're standing in it, right? Yeah.
I think there's certainly going to there's a lot of interesting questions. I think that by and large, with technology advances, they can all be resolved. But there's a whole lot that needs to be answered.
This could transform the world, really, and on many levels.
Yeah, and it has the potential to eliminate Metro North and buses and mass transit.
Tell me about Metro North.
So most people believe that driverless cars will reduce the cost substantially for every mile that somebody might want to travel in a private vehicle, that you'll share ownership, that you don't have to pay for the driver anymore, that there's so many benefits, and the computer will drive more efficiently, so they save on gas mileage. So that you can make it, if you can make it cheap enough and a nice experience, right? Like we talk about, you're in your living room in the car, or you're in your office in the car, that people will maybe be willing to pay a little bit more than they would for Metro North or for a bus, or feel that they don't need that.
Right.
And this takes them point to point rather than having a couple of, you know, stops in the way and driving to the train station or wherever. And so, and now they're talking about the Northeast Corridor and redoing the railroad there to add high speed rail. And so you have to start thinking about, you know, the governor's talking about widening 95.
Right.
When you're investing in these, you know, multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects, based on what you think the timeline is for driverless vehicles, some of those decisions may or may not be wise.
Yeah. Do you think the state is considering that? I mean, driverless vehicles and expansions, because there's a lot of money involved in that.
My guess is no.
Yeah, my guess is no. Right. But obviously, you're part of a state task force, and it's an obvious question to think about.
And I expect that if the task force meets and kind of gets really going in earnest, that eventually they'll have a better handle on what they realistically project the future to be in the timeline for driverless cars.
Is there any other aspect of this that you would like to discuss?
One other thing that I'll just point out is if you had everyone in these driverless vehicles and they're working really well, then there theoretically wouldn't be accidents. There'd be virtually no accidents, which means that cars wouldn't be made of steel anymore. They'd be made of very lightweight plastic or some other material.
Plastic?
because they don't need to be, they're heavy and now so that they're strong, so that if there is an accident, people are safe. But you would be using different materials, which again affects everyone from the producers and the importers and all of those materials. But it also means your gas mileage should skyrocket, or if it's electric driven, how long the charge will last will go much further because the vehicles are so much lighter. Which is kind of neat.
This is very neat. I mean, this is amazing.
So there's some interesting stuff out there.
There really is. And so you think that there's a shot in this legislative session? I know it's a little crazy up in Hartford, but to get going on this?
I think there's the task force is likely to meet and to start putting some things together. I think it's probably not until next fall at the earliest that there's any real recommendations that come out of the task force.
Are you the chair?
That may be the case. There's nothing official yet, but that's a possibility at this point. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're extremely knowledgeable. and it would be kind of fascinating to begin to take testimony.
And one of the things that, again, I don't think the task force will ultimately do, because I think the federal government will deal with, but are issues with the vehicles. And right now, humans make sort of snap decisions when emergencies come up.
Correct.
And these are going to have to be programmed into the vehicles. And so for I'll give you an example. So the car's coming around a corner. This driverless car is coming around the corner, going 50, and it's supposed to go 50. And there's a mountain on one side and cliff on the other, and you have a pedestrian in the middle of the road, and the car can run its calculations and it knows that it can't brake without hitting the pedestrian at a speed that would certainly kill the pedestrian. Its only other option, so it can run over the pedestrian and kill the pedestrian, it can crash into the mountain, more than likely killing the occupants of the car, or it can go off the cliff, more than likely killing the occupants of the car. It's got to make a decision about what's going to happen in that case. And there's a lot that are similar to that. So what does it do? Does it run over the pedestrian because they weren't supposed to be in the road? We're assuming that's the case. Does it matter if the car has one occupant or five occupants? Does it matter? I mean, what happens?
What's your answer?
Personally, I think that if the...
What would the computer say?
I think the computer should say... that whoever is violating sort of a rule of the road loses.
That's so at his or her own risk.
Right, because if you programmed it otherwise, if you said, well, avoid the pedestrian at all costs, then all pedestrians would know we no longer need to follow any of these rules because the cars will just avoid us.
Right.
And then you create lots of accidents and lots of deaths. If the rule is that if you're violating a rule of the road, you're gonna be the unfortunate one that gets injured or killed in the crash, then people are going to be, there's going to be a premium on following the rules of the road and preventing crashes. So that's where I would go.
Wouldn't that sort of, I'm just off the top of my head, but wouldn't this sort of be a federal decision in some respects? Because could every state do it itself? That would be crazy.
Right. So I think that when it comes to, and I think for the most part, and the federal government may, in my view, overreach, but at a minimum, the federal government really ought to be the one that regulates sort of the hardware and software on these cars, because it's not so feasible to say that, well, you have to manufacture your car to work in a certain way in Michigan, but then whenever it crosses the line, somehow it's got to be changed to comply with Illinois law.
Right, and going across, I mean, it would be wild for the computer to have to adjust to every state's rules.
Right, but on the other hand, it would not be difficult to have liability laws and insurance laws that differ from state to state, which is exactly what we have now.
Right. So we're talking about, if this ever took off, we're talking down the road, maybe this would take 50 years or 25 years or something to really get it going. No?
Yeah. I mean, I think you may see some out on the road, not in a testing mode, in 10 years, but that before they're really prevalent.
That for testing, right.
Well, yeah, or no, because there's some that are out there testing now. So I think 10 years, there might be some out there that are owned, working somewhere under certain circumstances. But to be widespread, working in sort of all weather conditions and road conditions and things like that, I think that's still a long ways off.
This is absolutely fascinating, Adam. I mean, I just following what you're doing. We're going to have you back on the program.
I'd love to be back.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it looks like our time is up. We could keep talking about this, and particularly, we'll get to other areas as well in another session. But this was a very fascinating topic, and we will have you back. And you can tell us about your foray into the legislative world, which moves at this grindingly small place, right? We want to thank you for coming to the studio today and for being with us in New Haven. Go to the newhavenindependent.org website, listeners, to get a podcast of this broadcast. Listen to the wide variety of shows that the station is producing each day. And thank you so much, Adam, for being here.
Thank you for having me, Marcia.
Thank you.